you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel that you can use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of the recording only by audio, and that way we can attach you to your arguments. I don't know if you were here earlier when I mentioned that we have three different podiums in front of you. The two on the sides closest to your tables are just for your convenience. If you're concerned for any health reasons, you want to use the one closer to you, certainly may. Otherwise, the one in the center has a button that allows you to elevate or lower the platform to match your height. You can use it at your convenience. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
May it please the court. Counsel. My name is Dylan Larson, and I'm a certified student attorney supervised by Bradford Colbert. Today we are here on behalf of appellant Jade Nichols. This case concerns predatory registration, and under Minnesota's problematic predatory registration statute, a person can be required to register as a predatory offender despite never being convicted of a predatory offense. And that's exactly what happened to Mr. Nichols. Despite never being convicted of a predatory offense, he has been required to register as a predatory offender for over 20 years. But what takes this case a step further is the fact that the state of Minnesota promised Mr. Nichols that he would not be required to register as part of his plea agreement. In reliance on that promise, Mr. Nichols pled guilty. Now the BCA seeks to renege on that promise and still require him to register as a predatory offender.
Mr. Larson, before you go much further in your argument, it seems that this court and our Supreme Court has addressed many of the issues that you're presenting to us for decision today. And I'm wondering what distinguishes this case from those others and what should compel us to either follow a different analysis or reach a different conclusion.
Yes, thank you. I think what distinguishes this case is the factual record shows that there was a clear and definite promise. I think the second fact that distinguishes this case is the fact that Mr. Nichols already tried unsuccessfully to withdraw his guilty plea. And so today, I would like to focus on the doctrine of promissory estoppel through the due process and Santabello lens. While I do think all of our claims today would provide relief for Mr. Nichols, there's certainly some hurdles in the case law, and that's why I think promissory estoppel has a new light, and I think Lange is one of the only opinions to address it in this context. Under the doctrine of promissory estoppel, there are three elements. One, there must be a clear and definite promise. Two, the promisor must have intended to induce reliance, and the promisee must have, in fact, relied on that promise to his detriment. And third, the promise must be enforced to prevent injustice. Starting with the first element, there's no question that there was a clear and definite promise, and there's four key pieces of evidence in this case that shows that clear and definite promise. The first comes from Mr. Nichols' affidavit, in which he swears under the penalty of perjury that as part of his plea agreement, he was promised that he would not be required to register as a predatory offender.
Well, it seems to me, given the summary judgment standard, that you have a strong argument that at least with the procedural posture we're viewing this case from, that we have to assume that that first element is met, given your client's affidavit evidence.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. And the district court, it wasn't really quite clear whether they found a promise. They pointed that they couldn't clearly find one in the record, but it didn't acknowledge kind of all the evidence that points to that clear and definite promise. But I think viewing the evidence most favorable in appellant's favor clearly indicates that there was a promise.
If we agree with you, then it seems to me we run straight into Lange, right, and into Lemmer, that suggests that when you have an entity that is not the promisor, and here we have, yes, we have, I think it was Crow Wing County, and then we have the BCA. They may both be the state, but they're not. At least that's what Lange says. Why is that wrong, and why should we reach a different conclusion about the application of promissory estoppel to the BCA under these circumstances?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's notable in Lange first that the opinion separates promissory estoppel from the due process under Santabello. And I'm arguing that they kind of run together, and other courts have done that, like the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And they applied promissory estoppel to the Cosby case. But the reason why Lange and Lemmerd don't defeat the case of Mr. Nichols is two reasons. And the first is that under Santabello, doctrines like privity aren't the square focused where the government makes a promise to a criminal defendant during plea bargaining. And instead, Santabello shifts that focus to due process, fundamental fairness, and faith. And so Santabello notes that plea bargaining is permeated with due process concerns. And so to adequately protect against those concerns, when a plea is induced by the promise or agreement of the prosecutor, then the defendant is entitled to the benefit of the bargain. And Santabello also notes that I think the phrase is the left hand must let the right hand know what it's doing. And I think what that means in this case is the burden is not on Mr. Nichols to understand whether a prosecutor from the state of Minnesota has the promissory authority to bind other agencies. And instead, I think that duty falls on the government to alert of its promises and such. Another case that illustrates why the privity doctrine shouldn't apply in this context is Fisher from the Supreme Court of Colorado. And in that case, Colorado Supreme Court bound the state by a promise made by an Oklahoma City police officer. So, and in that, they said that the proper focus of the issue is not whether the police officer had the promissory authority to bind another state, but instead it's on the due process rights of the criminal defendant.
Why aren't the due process rights satisfied here, given the fact that your client pursued post-conviction relief and, in fact, had a head process around whether the state breached the plea agreement warranting his ability to withdraw his guilty plea?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think his due process concerns weren't satisfied. One, because when he tried to withdraw his guilty plea, it was ultimately denied for timeliness and the burden on the state of reproving its case if he were to get his plea withdrawn. And so in Lange, it's noteworthy that this court said that Mr. Lange had failed to exhaust all of his post-conviction remedies. And so I think when you apply that here, Mr. Nichols did try and exhaust his post-conviction remedies. And still, he stuck today. He waived his right to a jury trial. He served his sentence. He completed his end of the deal, and yet he's still set to register until the end of this decade.
But due process involves notice and a right to a hearing. It doesn't necessarily guarantee a person a right to a hearing where they're going to prevail. And it seems like, you know, plea withdrawal was the appropriate remedy that he sought. It appears he just sought it too late. But my question goes to you're citing a Colorado case, and even in Lange, which is a non-presidential opinion, we acknowledged there was a comment made about how it's not even clear as to whether or not privity even applies to promissory estoppel. Is there any binding case law in Minnesota that actually does say privity does apply in a promissory estoppel claim?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, there is no Minnesota case law applying the concept of promissory estoppel and privity together. And my argument is that privity, we shouldn't even get to that point, and I don't think Mr. Nichols needs the BCA and the prosecutor to be in privity to have his promise enforced.
But if he's going to have his promise enforced, who is it going to be enforced by? And it seems to me that the proper party here would be the state, unless you can establish that you know, assuming a privity does apply to a promissory estoppel claim, let's assume it does for the sake of argument here, but you would have to have some other party that actually is in privity with the state, which means we would have to apply the privity analysis, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't agree, and that's, I think it comes from the factual distinction to State v. Lemmer. And I know that case sets out the privity rules.
And that's a binding case.
I agree, Your Honor. Thank you. I think the difference is it's in the collateral estoppel context. And so the issue in that case really is binding, is preventing different government agencies from infringing on each other's rights. But I think the focus of this case should be preventing the government from infringing on the citizens' constitutional rights. And so Lemmer also had a situation where there was two legal proceedings, and one for the Department of Public Safety under that implied consent revocation for the driver's license, and then one obviously for the DWI prosecution. But here, there's only one legal proceeding, and the BCA has no authority in a separate legal proceeding. And truly, the BCA's ability to require registration flows directly from the prosecutor's decision to charge in the case of Mr. Nichols. And so I don't think Lemmer should apply to this case where we're dealing with a governmental promise inducing plea bargaining rather than a case where the DPS has authority in a separate legal proceeding.
Before you run out of time on all of your issues, I want to make sure you have an opportunity to discuss your substantive due process, and I had a question about that. So if I understand the argument correctly, it was there's a fundamental right at stake, you argue, because parental rights are terminated. So the fundamental right is the right to parent. Is that not a bit too attenuated to attach a fundamental right to on the issue here? I mean, what if your client had been evicted from federally funded housing for some reason, and his rights to parent were terminated for failure to provide safe housing, hypothetically. I suppose you would then argue that the eviction itself triggers a fundamental right, and strict scrutiny would necessarily have to apply to the eviction.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, I do agree with that, and I think the factual record shows that Mr. Nichols' status as a predatory offender, at least in part, impacted his fundamental right to parent and ultimately the termination of his parental rights.
So you'd agree then, under my hypothetical, your argument would be the same, that he has a substantive due process right that would trigger strict scrutiny for the eviction proceeding, if the basis for the termination was failure to provide housing?
Yes, I think so.
And what is the strongest case that you were able to find to support that you would actually apply that, you'd actually consider a fundamental right to parenting if it is affected by some collateral proceeding?
I think Wehrlich is a good case for that, and although it dealt with threatened sexual abuse under a different statute, the court noted in its fundamental rights analysis that because it affects the presumption that a person is a good parent, I guess, it affects the presumption that they can parent, that it implicates a fundamental right. And I think that's...
I think the court said it may. I mean, that was a Rule 12 dismissal, as I understand it. And our Supreme Court said, you know what, that allegation is sufficient to state a claim that a fundamental right has been implicated. Here we have a record that shows that there is reference in the termination petition to your client's requirement to register. But there are references to many things, and he is offered a case plan and, in fact, ultimately decides voluntarily to terminate. So on this record, why did the district court err by concluding that his fundamental right to parent is not implicated?
I do agree that there's a lot of stuff that went into his termination of parental rights. I think it's at least a fact issue, and I think because the termination was cited by the caseworker, in the termination, the caseworker cited his duty to register as a predatory offender, that at least it's a fact issue to determine whether there was a fundamental right at stake.
Even though he voluntarily terminated, there was no involuntary termination pursuant to the petition. You still think it's a fact issue?
I do, and obviously, I mean, I don't know exactly where he was with that decision. I'm sorry, but I do think that it still played an impact on that, and that it's a fact issue.
Now, the social worker also pointed to his criminal history. So would prior convictions also be fall within strict scrutiny, fundamental rights, because they eventually might bear upon one's right to parent? You understand where my question is going. It's sort of, at some point, it seems a bit too attenuated.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm out of time. May I still?
You certainly may answer the question.
I do agree that there were quite a few things that may have gone into that determination. I just think that in this case, like pointing to Wehrlich and their language under the threatened sexual abuse statute, that the right to parent may kind of rise above that. And so any implication that he wasn't fit to parent, I think it at least presents a fact issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the respondent here. I guess I want to start since the appellant's argument was talking about substantive due process at the end, with this whole issue about this being attenuated. This has been something that we've brought up repeatedly in these arguments, and it's a problem because what the issue here in these cases is with the predatory offender registration statute, the constitutionality of that, and that's application 243-166. The parenting statute, the termination of parental rights statutes, or the child need of protective services statutes, those are human services statutes. They loop in 243-166, but it is very attenuated to the constitutionality of the predatory offender registration statute itself. But even if you look at that and get beyond the motion to dismiss and say that there's a fundamental right implicated because it brings in the registration, it's narrowed by how that statute's applied, whether or not actions go forward. So it's narrowly tailored in the first place to address children, you know, in need of harm. And the Wehrlich decision talks about that, you know, that one of the purposes of that statute. But then it's even more narrowly tailored by, you know, people looking at human services or prosecutors, county attorney's offices, look at whether or not to even go forward with the petition in those cases. And then it goes through, they're provided due process through the court process in any termination proceeding or child in need of protective services proceeding. In this particular case, it's a real problem because if you look at the record, it's mentioned that he's a predatory offender or he's required to register as a predatory offender. But there is just a boatload of other information in that petition and the supporting documentation as to why they proceeded in that with the termination action. And in addition, that the action started out against the mother of the child. It wasn't anything that was just started because he was required to register as a predatory offender. So I think there are some big problems with the attenuation of that, the statute, but even if we buy that somehow it should be linked to the predatory offender registration statute, it fails on the facts of this case to show any kind of constitutional violation. One of the things that appellant started his argument saying a conviction's not required. A conviction under the statute is required. It either has to be for one of the listed predatory offenses or something out of the same set of circumstances. So a conviction is required, and they repeatedly say that he was required to register based on something that was dismissed, but it was dismissed and he was convicted out of the same set of circumstances. So I just want to clarify, this is not something where anytime somebody is charged, they have to register. It's based on a conviction out of the same set of circumstances.
I think the bigger concern I have, and as appellant's counsel articulated, is the notion of the state making a promise that it has reneged on for 20 years, as I understand it. I understand Lemmer talks about the notion of privity, but that's a very different context of collateral estoppel. Here you have an equitable principle or equitable relief being sought because a private citizen has had their promise, or the state has breached a promise with a private citizen. Isn't that a distinction between Lemmer and this case that ought to make a difference?
Actually, I don't think it should make a difference. I think from a privity standpoint, it should be actually a similar analysis if it's applied at all. As Judge Reyes indicated, there is no authority in Minnesota that says that privity even applies in a promissory estoppel action. But if you apply it, it's the same type of analysis. The BCA in this case had nothing to do with that criminal case. It's not a case where their position was heard. They had no control over if the parties misunderstood the law. They had no control over if they made a plea bargain that was not legal under the law. So both the criminal court, when he raised this, and he raised this in 2000, gosh, I think it was like 10 years after.
2010, I believe.
2010, yeah. 10 years after. So he's been registering at that point for over 10 years. One of the things that the criminal court pointed out is if this was such a big part of the plea bargain, why did you wait 10 years? And even though part of the reason for the dismissal was the timeliness on the post-conviction, the court did look at it, and the criminal court said there wasn't a clear and definite promise. So it did
but
look it, at actually...
Is that finding really supported by the record, though? It didn't seem to me, after carefully reviewing that, the record truly supported it. And the district court even seemed to qualify its statement on there. I mean, looking back at what happened there, it seems like there was a promise made that you're not going to have to register.
I don't know if there's a clear and definite promise. I think from the record, I think the word they use is we're attempting basically to avoid registration. I think he said this is an attempt to avoid registration. It wasn't clear to me from the record that was part of the plea agreement, but he did say
the
they were attempting
intent,
to avoid.
The purpose and intent, right? Wasn't the prosecutor's statement at the time of the plea hearing, it's our purpose and intent to relieve him of any responsibility to
no,
register.
It was the defense attorney's statement, actually. Maybe he said purpose and intent, but it was the defense attorney's statement. And then the prosecutor was asked if they agreed with what was said, and he didn't say anything about the registration, but just said, yes, that's consistent with, and when they had talked to the victim.
Wouldn't that include then the statement by the defense attorney of the intent of avoiding registration?
Right.
Prosecutor didn't say, no, we agree with everything but the registration. We want him to register as well. Right. There is no clear refutation of the statement by defense counsel. And to the contrary, there is an affirmation by the state, including the statement for to try to avoid registration, right?
Correct. And I think that what I'm saying is I don't think it's necessarily clear it's part of the plea bargain, but it's clear that they were trying to avoid registration is what I'm saying.
But if that's what they're agreeing to, isn't that part of the plea bargain then?
Well, let's say it is. Even if it is, the BCA is not bound by that based on the promissory estoppel.
Yeah, so, I'm glad you raised that because that's another concern I have, because if you look at the Lemmer case, that involved the Commissioner of Public Safety in a civil proceeding versus a criminal proceeding. Here, this is solely focused on the criminal proceeding. So you've got the state through the county, and then you've got the BCA, which enforces that the what occurs in the criminal proceeding. There's no separate proceeding for the BCA. So if in terms of the entities and whether or not there's any privity, it seems to me that this is much, much closer than the Lemmers case with the Commissioner of Public Safety and the state.
I would respectfully disagree with that. I think it's fairly similar. While there's not a separate civil action, there is a separate civil registration process that the BCA administers based on what happens in the criminal case. But they don't have, similarly to the Lemmer case, the BCA's interests aren't protected in that administration as far as the criminal case is concerned. We have a statute that specifically says the court may not modify the duty to register. We have parties who were presumably mistaken about the application of the statute, but it's a statutory requirement that's enforced by the BCA separately from any criminal proceedings.
Well, I'm not so sure it's separate from it, because basically I think under the statute, the BCA has to implement what has been decided in the criminal proceeding, which I think brings it closer. And why I think when you're looking at it, as Judge Berkman said, you know, promissory estoppel, you're really talking about equitable principles here, not necessarily legal, but equitable principles of if an agreement is not being enforced, shouldn't it be enforced, and how is the best way to have it enforced?
The best way to have it enforced is the exclusive remedy, which is post-conviction relief, which he sought and he lost. Whether he lost by time, whether he lost by the merits, whether he lost by both, that was his remedy. He didn't even appeal when he lost. So that was his remedy. So that was, you know, is it equitable at this point to hold the BCA responsible for a promise that was made 20 years ago that the BCA didn't make, that he already had a chance to challenge in the criminal case and lost and didn't appeal? It doesn't even seem like that's equitable at this point based on the records in this case from a promissory estoppel standpoint. But in any event,
well, I think part of it is, I'm just speaking for myself, but in terms of equity, should the state be allowed and the BCA allowed to enforce, to go back on a promise that had been made? And, you know, I understand the statute of limitations arguments and all the other arguments, but from an equitable standpoint, is that really right? Is that really fair for a promise that had been made to not be enforced?
I think it is right and fair, and I think the remedy, if there was a remedy, was for the plea bargain, for the plea to be withdrawn. Because then if the plea agreement was not, if the promise in the plea agreement was not kept, the remedy was for that plea to be withdrawn. Then he doesn't have the conviction anymore. Then he doesn't have to register. So that is the remedy. And, you know, and if you look at, you know, these many cases which the appellant cited as far as these promissory estoppel cases and these constitutional cases, we went in our brief and we distinguished each case, but it's the consistent thing in each of those cases is either there were people from a promissory estoppel standpoint and from a, I guess when you're looking at the privity issue. I don't know if they specifically addressed it as privity, but these were like a prosecutor in the same office as that prosecutor who made the promise. A prosecutor later on in that same office who made the promise. Somebody who was involved, like one of them was an IRS thing. Well, the IRS was the client, was part of that proceeding. So it's just very consistent that That's a consistent difference in all of those cases, is that in this case, the BCA, yes, they're both, you know, one's a prosecutor for the state and one's a BCA, But the BCA, in the same way, and I cited some cases that deal with human services and things like that, you know, they can't be bound by somebody else making a promise that they weren't authorized to make in the first place. And again, if you're going to apply the contract principles of plea bargains, the remedy was the post-conviction relief. And it's not equitable then to go beyond that. It's not the BCA's responsibility or fault that this promise was made or that the post-conviction remedy was not successful in Mr. Nichols' case. And it's not their responsibility that he was late in seeking it or that he didn't appeal when he lost. If you have no other questions, I'll rest on our brief for the rest of it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
I just have a few points I'd like to make. The first is that I want to make sure before I leave that there's no question that there was a clear and definite promise. And the
BCA. Is it an enforceable promise? Would a district court judge have been had the authority to not require predatory offender registration?
At the original, it's not really clear under the statute. I mean, the statute says that the BCA has the sole authority to enforce registration. So even if the judge had known or tried to enforce it, I don't think he would have been able to, since the sentencing court can't modify registration requirements under the statute.
So was it an unenforceable plea agreement that the parties entered into?
Well, it's definitely an unfulfillable promise.
Unfulfillable. You're using the right term. Thank
sorry.
You.
It's definitely an unfulfillable promise. And I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Nichols' attorney and the prosecutor and the judge all kind of failed him in that case by letting him make that deal.
So if it's an unfulfillable promise, what's the remedy for an unfulfillable promise that's made in a plea agreement?
I believe it's plea withdrawal.
Right, and so didn't he have that opportunity in this case?
Yes, he did have that opportunity to withdraw his plea, and unfortunately for him, that it was denied as for untimely. But I don't think that has to defeat his claim, and I think in Lange and...
Why not? Why isn't that enough in and of itself? Why shouldn't it just end at that point?
Well, because he still has not received the benefit of his bargain. And in Lange and in State v. James, they note that the remedy is either plea withdrawal or specific performance of the terms of the agreement.
But that's where we run into that conundrum here is you can't have specific performance if, as Judge Bjorkman pointed out, the district court didn't even have the authority to exclude the predatory registration as part of the plea agreement. So it seems like that avenue is closed, so the only avenue that's available is plea withdrawal.
I do think so, and I think that's where the injustice and the third element of the promissory estoppel comes in. Yes, the district court didn't have the authority to modify the plea agreement, and so this is really Mr. Nichols' last remedy, and I think that's the injustice here, that the state is allowed to make a promise during plea bargaining and then renege on that promise. And now we're at the point where he's going to be, by the end of this, as it currently stands, he'll have registered for over 30 years.
But isn't really the issue not so much that the state reneged on a promise made, even assuming that that's what occurred, but that the, you know, both parties and the district court were mistaken in agreeing to something that agreeing to a promise that was unfulfillable.
Yes, Your Honor, I do think that's the issue, but I don't. I think when you say that that the proper remedy is specific performance or plea of withdrawal. I think that this is his last remedy right here, and I think this court has the authority to make new law and provide Mr. Nichols a path to remedy the injustice that's occurred to him.
Well, do we have the authority to make new law? I thought we were an error-correcting court. Isn't that really up to the Supreme Court or the legislature?
Yes, but I... yes, sorry. And so I will just quickly conclude, if there's no more questions, that there was definitely a clear and definite promise here. And I think the proper focus here is not on whether the BCA and the Crow Wing County prosecutor were in privity. And instead, the question is on fundamental fairness and due process. And so I think looking at this case, if there was a clear and definite promise, which I said there was, then the promise must be enforced as a matter of fundamental fairness. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The matter is submitted. Thank you for your briefing. Thank you for your oral argument. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.